This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 239 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Spring has sprung here, Max, for once. We actually had a nice day, and I discovered tonight that I'm doomed because we had our first visit from the ice cream truck.
Oh, yeah, that's a major milestone for 2018. Wow. Very good. So did you buy some ice cream?
No, I did not buy any ice cream, but I only when I visited family in upstate New Jersey did we ever have access to an ice cream truck other than my brother's who owned a ice cream truck when he was in college. So I've never had an ice cream truck arrive at my house before. This was a new experience. So, but we're not here to talk about delivery trucks unless suddenly we're going to have ice cream deliveries by drones. But we are going to talk about Google and their companies protesting. The NBAA warns of commercial UAS violations, anti-drone system sales and criminality, drones and phones changing the way vacationers plan their trips. This week in FAA news, some listener mail and the Genius New York results. They awarded their $1 million, as well as some shout outs and listener mail. So I think we got a full show. So should we get started?
Let's get started, David.
Our first story comes this week from We Talk UAV. 3,100 Google employees protest company's involvement in Pentagon drone project. Google's motto is don't be evil, and their 3,100 employees have decided if they're working with the Pentagon, they're not following that motto. What do you think, Max?
Right. This is about the United States Department of Defense's Project Maven, which is kind of unique in that it looks at applying machine learning and artificial intelligence to weapons systems to detect objects. And apparently Google has been working with DOD to develop the algorithms that support this. I think, David, it's basically a process of analyzing drone footage and then identifying objects, targets, things like that. But as you say, 3,100 of the Google employees don't like this idea. They sent a letter to CEO Sundar Pichai expressing their displeasure.
And the opening paragraph is, "We believe that Google should not be in the business of war. Therefore, we ask Project Maven to be canceled and that Google draft, publicize, and enforce a clear policy stating that neither Google nor its contractors will ever build warfare technology." This is really surprising. It's not often you hear a company revolt against its management based on its management's principles. What do you think, Max?
I think that's true. I think Google enjoys a fairly unique corporate culture. There are other companies that have a similar kind of environment, but a lot of the people at Google believe in what they're doing and believe that it's for the benefit of, well, all of us. And they see this is kind of an indirect association, I guess, in that Google is not actually doing anything specific in terms of targeting or weapons launch or anything like that. But these employees seem to think that it's too close. It's too close. And that they say that this is a threat to Google's reputation. And they're really making some explicit demands, right? They conclude the letter saying that they request that this project be canceled immediately, and that, as you mentioned, David, this policy statement be made and publicized, that Google will, or its contractors, will never build warfare technology. I guess we'll have to see how Google executives react to this. But clearly, I mean, 3,100 employees have some concerns.
And Google's a big place. We don't know how many people are working on the Maven program. It's a bit of an internal revolt. It's a culture that the top down have created, and now they created it. Now they have to live by it. So interesting. I think we'll like you said, we'll have to follow up on it. And what's also interesting is if you implement this, what they want, how do you support your subcontractors that are required to not work against work in the business of war? I mean, start filing your subcontractors, and I'm sure Google has lots of subcontractors that might actually, who deal with tech hardware that work for the Pentagon also. Do they give up working for the Pentagon, or do they give up working for Google? And does Google have a right to enforce that?
Yeah, I think the values that these Google employees have are, I think, pretty specific, but it can be very, very difficult to determine where is that line that you draw, where do you cross that line, and it's not always so clear-cut. It's the kind of a drone-related story that I don't think we contemplated in the past, so interesting to follow.
So let's go move over to another organization that's a little upset with drones, and that's NBAA. And this was from AIN Online. NBAA warns of commercial UAS violations. The National Business Aviation Association expresses concern about UAVs and their registration, etc. And more to the point, they're worried about hobbyists more so than people who are flying professionally.
Exactly. In fact, they're worried that operators of drones who consider themselves to be recreational flyers and not subject to things like Part 107 and regulations that apply to commercial use, the NBAA is worried that some of these guys don't really appreciate what commercial use means, and that they are at times engaged in what really does amount to commercial use. The NBAA released an item, UAS operators must understand what commercial use entails, and they provide some examples of the sort of thing they're talking about. So, for example, someone who's a home inspector, and they bought their DJI Phantom or whatever at a local store or online or whatever, and they use that drone to fly up and take a look at the roof. Well, that's commercial use. Another example they cite is, let's say, a landscaper who is photographing jobs using a drone that they plan to use in the advertising of their business. Well, that's a commercial use. And so the NBAA is worried that there are, I don't know how many, David, maybe a lot, of people who are flying in ways that amounts to commercial use, but either don't realize it or they do and they don't care, and they're not operating under Part 107.
I don't know. And that was a giant sigh, folks. Education, like I learned in Baltimore. We've got to keep up educating people. And no matter what, this is going to happen. NBAA is concerned that it's going to possibly affect them due to a crash or something. So they're putting the word out, but this is going to be a challenge going forward. I mean, someone who's a landscaper and thinks, oh, wow, I got a drone for Christmas and I can use it to take some pictures of what I'm doing. That's really cool. And it's my own website. What difference does it make if I put my own pictures on there? You can understand their thinking. How do you educate the people to bring that online? So I don't know that answer yet.
And I don't know if there's any direct relationship or correlation, but we have seen in the past couple of months a number of organizations make statements that they believe that the drone flyers who are currently categorized as recreational should also be subject to much broader regulations, identification and tracking of drones, registration, a number of different things. With this situation where we separate out and say that recreational flying has a much simpler rule set than commercial does, and you know, here we see NBAA bringing up the point that some of the recreational flyers are crossing over into the commercial arena, in a way that kind of supports the argument that everybody should be subject to the same rules. So I don't know if that's a motivation or an additional motivation for the NBAA to bring this out in this way, but there does seem to kind of be a little bit of a linkage between the two.
And that driver is probably coming from the federal government, the FAA and Department of Homeland Security, as well as some of other drone organizations. So I think there is a consensus growing now, Max, that personal UAVs or consumer UAVs or social users or however you want to call them are going to have to be regulated like the commercial users. It's kind of funny, given this week that we've had Mr. Zuckerberg up on Capitol Hill testifying about Facebook and how social media has become commercialized. So we've got a parallel there. Does that mean, you know, just like Facebook being talked about being regulated, it's no different than consumer drones or people who are flying just casually. They might need to be regulated too. It's an interesting parallel how technology now has gotten ahead of everybody else. And now we're looking at it going, well, maybe we need to rein it in a bit. So we'll see. We do know one thing, which is if you're a Swiss engineer, you don't want to sell anti-drone systems to somewhere so they would end up in foreign governments, right, Max?
Yes, yes. This comes from swissinfo.ch. Swiss engineer arrested for illegal anti-drone system sales. And this occurred when the Italian financial crime police arrested actually not just a Swiss engineer, but two people for selling anti-drone systems. It was that Swiss engineer as well as an Italian entrepreneur who were arrested. And they allegedly sold systems that can detect, track, and neutralize UAVs. As it's reported here, it's a jamming kind of approach. So it jams communication to the drone and jams the global satellite navigation system and uses that method to bring down drones. So they had a plan for selling this that was a little bit, it was kind of indirect in some ways, David.
Well, the road to the Middle East is through Spain. They clearly were trying to do this on the down low. So they had Middle Eastern buyers show up in Spain and they were trying to send them through the EU and then have from Spain have them arrive in the Middle East. Clearly, these were designed for Middle Eastern countries, and the article didn't specify if they were nation states or maybe terrorist organizations. But needless to say, it's probably a good thing that the Italian police got a hold of these guys and put their nefarious business out of business.
One of the broader points of all this, I think, is the issue of export control. And a lot of people who develop products may not have a history where they've been familiar with the export control laws of the country in which they operate. And sometimes seemingly innocuous devices or technology is on the list of export control items. And if you run afoul of the local laws in that area, you can find yourself in some serious hot water. So if you're trying to export some products or technology related to drones that you've been working on, that might be very exciting and you might look forward to a global market and lots of business, but you have to be aware of the export control limitations that may exist for you. Sort of a word to the wise.
And this is talking from someone who knows.
Yes.
Who dealt with this. And I know that we've talked about this on Airplane Geeks, but it may not have been the whole system that was export controlled.
Right.
It could have been just a part of it that would be. So like you said, it's a interesting pitfall for you to succumb, though I think these were a little more nefarious than someone just making a mistake that their equipment was patent. But we won't know until they go to trial.
Mm.
But let's take a vacation from all of this depressing news that we've had so far. And this is from reviewjournal.com. Drones, phones, changing the way vacationers plan their trips. The $1 million travel industry. $1 trillion travel industry at the National Association of Broadcasters show, the NAB. Marketing panelists and the cottage industry of travel videos is virtual reality filmed by drones. So live it before you live it, or see it before you live it.
Ooh, I like that. Did you think of that?
I did.
Yeah, that's good. Maybe you should be in the marketing business, David.
Oh, maybe. I should start writing copy, huh?
Yeah, maybe. So, yeah, this obviously a trillion-dollar industry is pretty significant. And it's another example of how drone technology is being contemplated, thought of, embraced for interesting purposes. In this case, I mean, if you're trying to promote travel to a particular location, I think we're all aware of the kinds of marketing approaches that are used, a lot of, you know, photographs, magazines, videos of the area and so forth. But drones can certainly add a lot to that. And we've seen a lot of really spectacular drone video that in some cases just makes you want to, you know, call up the airline, get a ticket and head out. But this industry is looking, you know, beyond that, virtual reality. What if you can walk through that little Italian village or climb up that, that mountain in the Alps or and experience the views in a virtual reality kind of way?
Or see that par five on the dog leg left
right
of the golf course on the island you're going to play. It's funny. All I could think of was when you said that, you know, watch these videos and you suddenly want to pack your things. Your comment the other night on our episode where we had the videos of the Iceland waterfalls.
Yes.
That was your first comment afterwards was, I want to get on an airplane and suddenly I want to go to Iceland.
Hurry.
So clearly the power of video and drone video and eventually immersion is like Ready Player One. Must-see movie if you are involved with this. Drones are play a evil role, but they are very prominent in the movie. So it's interesting that we're moving from video to immersion, and drones will be a huge part of that.
And this is an opportunity for people who are interested in a career. Travel photography is something that a lot of photographers aspire to, professional photographers, advanced amateurs. Just the notion of being able to travel around the world, get paid to do that, and take great photographs. The difficulty is that it's extremely competitive. There really are relatively small number of photographers who can make a good living doing that. So here we introduce something new, drones and virtual reality. And that's an opportunity, I think, for new players to get into this travel industry and participate as producers of these kinds of travel videos. So, yeah, I think big opportunity.
Can you tell the two photography geeks are on the show?
I know. I get sort of worked up over this. You can't get rich traveling around the world taking pictures. Maybe you can get rich traveling around the world flying drones.
There you go. Well, if you're going to travel around the United States, there's a good chance you're going to have to ID your drone. Ooh, another good segue. This was from Lexology.com. FAA's ARC submits recommendations on UAS ID tracking despite lack of consensus. The Aviation Rulemaking Committee, or ARC, ARC, has provided the FAA some recommendations on drone ID. And again, this was a huge discussion in Baltimore when I was there about who's going to ID you, how are you going to do it, et cetera. And the rulesmaking committee has come up with some answers.
They have, and they did not achieve a complete consensus, primarily like on the thresholds for the ID and tracking requirements. But they did make a number of recommendations. One is that tracking requirements apply to UAS pilots, not to the manufacturers, that the manufacturers would be required to indicate whether the products met the ID and tracking requirements, and if so, that they would have to turn on the ID and tracking system without giving pilots the option to turn them off. As far as those thresholds, they provided a couple of options. Instead of a single recommendation, a couple of options, two of them. First is that all UAS comply with the ID and tracking requirements, except for certain types of operations, such as flights that stay within visual line of sight, recreational flights, significantly, and operations under air traffic control. That's the first option. The second option is that the requirements would apply to UAS that can fly without active control of the remote pilot, so that means autonomous, or further than 400 feet from the control station. So they're kind of handing that to the FAA and saying, here's our two recommended options. You decide what you want to go with.
And of course, they want to exclude UASs that have ATC equipment. So eventually we're going to have UASs with ADS-B. So they don't need to have identification because the ADS-B or the transponders will provide that identification. And those also describe anybody who's flying under an FAA waiver. Because if you're flying under an FAA waiver, the FAA knows who you are and what you're about to do. And they propose two methods of identifying and tracking UASs. The first is direct broadcast, which local data transmission with standards so the UAS and receivers can communicate. So what that means is the moment you take off, you're broadcasting your ID and your identifier, kind of like ADS-B. And the other option, Max?
Is what they're calling network publishing, whereas instead of transmitting data locally to those around you, you transmit data to a central database that is accessible to clients, including things like air traffic control or public officials. So two really different methods. The way I look at it is one is kind of a decentralized approach, the direct broadcast approach, and the other is sort of a centralized approach, the network publishing approach. So we'll have to see what the FAA decides. Now, the FAA is supposed to publish an advanced NPRM, a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, in May of this year, 2018. But they may not make that because the DOT, the Department of Transportation, is still reviewing the proposed rules. And after that, which was supposed to occur in February, the Office of Management and Budget was supposed to review the proposed rules. So it looks like we're a little bit behind the original plan.
But of course, if you continue to listen to the UAV Digest, the moment the NPRM comes up, we will be happy tear through it and read through it. I think we've done this before. Did you ever get a sense of deja vu? This is probably as important as the last RPM we went through.
Yes.
Even more so probably now. So I'm kind of looking forward to taking our experience of learning from now how to read notice of proposed rulemakings and giving our listeners even more in-depth.
Great.
Well, another friends of the show, which is the Genius New York competition, they provided their winners. And this is from Syracuse.com. And the winner was Swiss-based Photokite.
That's right. And they'll enjoy a $1 million grand prize as a result. What Photokite is looking at is a tethered drone, one that can stay aloft almost indefinitely by virtue of the fact that the cord, the retractable cord, could include a power source, and this tethered drone would be able to fly autonomously, of course, within the bounds of its tether, but also send live video to the ground. And they've got a couple of applications that they are tending to focus on.
Fire departments, law enforcement agencies, broadcasters, and sports teams. When I was at Baltimore, one of the things that when CNN got their FAA waiver for manned overflight was one of their options was a tethered UAV. And so here we have Photokite, which is using a tether. And to be able to have a sustained presence, if you go back and listen to one of really long things, we talked about a heliostat, which was a giant dirigible that was tethered that was providing real-time surveillance as a drone for the federal government and air defense. So Photokite's pretty small and portable, but as long as you have it hooked up to the power source, it can fly forever. And real-time video of a crisis area or a riot or a fire to provide hotspots for fire departments so that they can direct where they need to attack the fires. All of these are really cool applications for something where you would have a tethered drone.
Yeah, at first when I saw this, David, I'll be honest with you, I'm thinking a tethered drone, that just doesn't sound as exciting as something that's untethered and autonomous, able to avoid obstacles, all of those kinds of things. But the more I thought about these applications, the more sense it made to me that this is really, really something that's significant with a lot of really great applications. We'll have obviously a link in the show notes to the article, as well as to Photokite, which is spelled F-O-T-O-K-I-T-E. But they also list the other five finalists who also received cash prizes, smaller than the grand prize. But we have Quantafly that uses advanced imaging processing technology to analyze and quantify changes in the urban environment. True Weather, they're looking at a service to improve the accuracy and communication of weather intelligence. Drop Copter, a technology that allows farmers to pollinate orchards using drones. Also receiving some funding money was Precision Vision, a little rhyming name there. That's for image processing technology. And USPLM, they develop integrated, scalable drone fleet management software. So congratulations to all of these companies receiving some funding from Genius New York.
Our first feedback from the week comes from Gareth in Melbourne. Hi, geeks. Our local tunnel has just been mapped by drone. I've included the original email with links to the media release. Love the show. And this was from Malachi MP. They are using a drone to map tunnels for self-driving automobiles. It's kind of interesting that the autonomous aircraft is helping the autonomous car in Australia.
That's right. There's a toll road operator, Eastlink, And one of the tunnels they operate is this Mullum Mullum Tunnel. And what they did is took a drone that was equipped with LIDAR to map the inside of the tunnel. So they closed down the tunnel for maintenance, and then they flew this drone through it, and it produces an extremely detailed map of the inside of the tunnel, which is something that self-driving cars can use or will need to use in order to pass safely through the tunnel. There's a video that shows the drone that we'll have in the show notes, and take a look at that. It's pretty exciting. Good application.
And ready for this, Max? I actually thought this through on why do you need to map a tunnel for a self-driving car? Self-driving cars, as a general rule, use GPS and satellite technology. And if anybody has driven through a tunnel using and has XM radio or GPS, bye-bye tunnel, it doesn't get through the mountain. So if you have a completely mapped out, the auto drive can use the LIDAR mapping to get through the tunnel. Otherwise, it's not going to get through the tunnel because there's no signal to drive it.
Makes sense.
I thought I was very clever for coming up with that. The historian and marketer came up with, oh, I get this. This makes perfect sense.
Very good. Well, we also received a email from listener John Henry about something the University of Michigan is doing.
They've opened an outdoor drone testing facility, which is really kind of funny because John Henry email says, University of Michigan opened an outdoor drone testing facility. It's fully enclosed. So what I'm assuming is they have a drone cage.
A big, big drone cage.
And because it's a really, really big drone cage, the FAA considers it indoors, which interesting way to circumvent a loophole. What do you think, Max?
It's contained. It's a five-story netted enclosure. It's 80 feet by 120 feet. So this thing is quite large, and this enables, well, students and companies to use it to test experimental algorithms, to test drones. I think this is a great idea.
And we've seen drone cages, and they're very useful and effective. The AI Institute at Langley has basically a building that's a giant drone cage. So very cool. And he also recommends we speak to Professor Ella Akins. So we'll follow up with that. And there is a video of the week that comes with this that he says is a must-watch what not to do tutorial in the first 10 minutes. And I have to agree, it's definitely what not to do as a drone pilot. And last but not least, I have a bit of a shout-out. We were approached by the Data Crunch podcast, and if we could do some synergy between our show and theirs. I did go out and listen to them. It's a great show. I'm not a big data expert, but the episodes I listened to were very down to earth and very interesting. It's a well-produced show. So we'll have links to the show notes to the Data Crunch podcast. It looks like they're putting out one every month or so, and it's about a 30 to 40 minute show. Very well done. And again, big data is part of what we talk about on a semi-regular basis because all these drones create all this data. And what are we going to do with it? So I highly recommend it. And thanks for Jeanette, one of the hosts, reaching out to us. And if you're in the data side of this industry, definitely check it out.
Well, with that, I think it's about time to bring this episode to a close. We want to thank you all for listening to episode 239 of the UAV Digest. Be sure to find us at our website, theuavdigest.com. We've got some pretty good show notes for each episode. You can find those for this episode by visiting theuavdigest.com/239.
And of course, we have little to no social media presence, so if you really want to find us, you can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, Facebook.com/UAV Digest. You can email us, and that would be feedback@theuavdigest.com. And of course, we want you to use that address, that email address, to ask us to send you a link so you can become part of our Slack listener team. where we talk about big data and the FAA and other things that purvey aviation and drones. If you want to help us, you could leave us some feedback at Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. And you can always purchase some swag at our Cafe Press store. But most of all, we want to thank you for listening. So this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
See you next week.